Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
This is Sound Effect, and I'm Jennifer Wing. Right now, you're listening to a four-year-old child who's wearing a tiny suit and tie, playing the drums in our studios here in Belltown, Seattle.
Play drums makes me feel like Daddy's playing with me, like just go to school, have fun like school, just play.
Who taught you how to play the drums?
Well, Daddy actually taught me.
I am Devon Lewis. I play drums, music with various bands around town, have my own bands, and that's my son, Donovan Lewis. We have this video, I think he was probably like maybe 3 to 6 months. He had some sticks in his hand, you know, and playing on the carpet. So he and like saying like so he's making his own song. So yeah, it's been like since he was born. It's our family DNA, music. So it was a given.
I'm Dave Lewis Jr. and this is my son Devon, and that's my grandson Donovan. My grandfather Dave Lewis Sr. taught my father Dave Lewis all that he knew. And this was back in the 50s and 60s where my grandfather taught Quincy Jones, Jimi Hendrix, and Dave Lewis in the basement at his house.
I used to always say, I want to play guitar, you know. And then I seen a picture of my dad on the drums, and then that's when I was like, okay, yeah, I'm going to really take it seriously. So
you remember seeing that picture for the first time?
Yeah, I was a little older, yeah.
Do you still have it?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I know. Yeah.
I think Roosevelt was a big influence on you, too, Mr. Brown, the jazz program, the jazz program there.
Yeah.
That's where you learned to read music.
How does it feel for the two of you to sit and watch Donovan play and to be so comfortable and so at ease at that drum set? He's only 4 years old.
I just watch in amazement, you know, let him explore on his own, figure it out, you know. You know, the real teaching is going to be teaching him the business part. That's what I told him.
You always do something, like, you always try to pay gigs and money.
Donovan, you're going to be a fine player. That's natural. The real lesson is how to deal with people, how to get to your gig on time, how to be professional, and he'll get it. He'll start coming with me to different. He'll come with me to different shows and he'll play. So we'll have company. He'll start playing. You know, people, friends come over. He'll set up a little set. He's giving a show. He's already ready. A little. He's more of an entertainer than me, but yeah.
Three generations of musicians in one room talking about music. Each one has a hand in shaping the other. Pint-sized Donovan, who's been playing the drums his whole short life, is lucky enough to have the guidance of both his father and grandfather. Today on Sound Effect, the theme is Under the Influence. We'll hear what it's like to have a mentor who's kind of hard to love. One woman shares her story about being in rehab for an Adderall addiction. And we'll learn about a new trend in the publishing world. Authors looking to erase bias and prejudice in their work, they're paying for advice on how to do that. These stories and so much more today on Sound Effect. So think about the people who have influenced your life, who have imparted helpful advice and guidance. What if the person you wanted as a mentor, what if they said, actually, no, I am going to learn from you? Well, this is what happened to African-American Seattle screenwriter and teacher Brian McDonald, who struck up a friendship with the legendary Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright August Wilson, who was also Black. August Wilson spent the last years of his life in Seattle. He died when he was 60 in 2005 from liver cancer. He wrote a series of 10 plays called The Pittsburgh Cycle, one of which is Fences. Fences was adapted into a film in 2016. But before we get to the relationship between August and Brian, here is a snippet of Mr. Wilson giving a speech at Seattle Center in 2001 about what it means to be an artist.
It's your world. Make art, but make justice too. Create symphonies, but create systems that allow for full participation in America's virtues and full participation in America's wealth. Design ways to take advantage of all of the society's potential. Settle for nothing less. And give to each hallowed star its own appointed orbit. And many roads will open for you. Thank you.
I actually play that in my classes. I let August take over the class for a little while, and I put an empty chair in front of the class, and I talk about him a little bit, and then I let him take over. It's usually how I end my classes at the film school.
When did you meet him?
Mid-90s, I guess I met him the first time. I saw him standing around, you know, it was like a mall that doesn't exist anymore, a little teeny mall, and there were movie theaters there. And I had seen a film with some friends. I looked down below, and reading the newspaper was a guy I thought was August Wilson. So I walked downstairs because I didn't want to let this moment pass. And I think I have to preface meeting him with this. At that time, I had probably been struggling as a screenwriter for 15 years and hit a lot of the barriers you hit when you're an African-American screenwriter. And so to see a guy who had summited that mountain in some way, even though it's a sister form, it meant a lot just to shake his hand. And so I went and introduced myself. I said, excuse me, are you August Wilson? And he looked up from the newspaper. He was always reading the New York Times. He read it all the time. And he looked like I was going to serve him a subpoena or something. Like, I don't know what the deal was, or maybe I pulled him out of his reading. I don't know what the deal was, but I asked him and he said yes. And then I explained who I was, and it was a really pleasant conversation. And in fact, I think it was that conversation where he gave me his number, like the first or second time. He said, well, give me a call. And I called him a couple of times, but mostly I would just see him on the street. And those times became more frequent. And then he was going to the coffee shop I would go to. And we were moving from close acquaintances into friendship, I think, when he got sick. So I would call him a friend, but I didn't get as close as I would have liked to.
But you did get close.
I got close to him, yeah.
And what was that relationship like when you found that you were there?
I had given him a copy of a film that I'd made.
Whiteface, right?
Whiteface, mm-hmm. Yeah. Thinking, you know, it's just something I've done. And he became a huge fan of it. And the next time I saw him, he was on the other side of the street, and he crossed the street to talk to me, to quote the movie to me. He was laughing as he talked about it. And after that, it was different. He would ask me for advice. So he was working on a play. I remember I was on the phone. I saw him across the street. I was on my cell phone. I waved at him. He crossed the street, and he waited patiently for me to get off the cell phone. And finally, I thought, August Wilson wants to talk to me. Maybe I should get off the phone. I cut my conversation short. I got off the phone, and he asked me a very specific question about his play that he was working on. I couldn't be more proud that I had something, I don't know how much, to do with how that play turned out.
Do you recognize any of your voice in that play?
August would have conversations with you, and then you'd see a play, and they would have the same conversation in this play. It was like he was guiding the conversation in a way. It wasn't like he stole any lines from you or anything. But the lines that he spoke were exactly the same in the play as they were in the conversation.
So you recognize conversations that you had with him in that play.
Yeah.
And to go back to that moment in the movie theater when you spotted him and you realized, oh, this is the guy. I've been waiting to run into him. Could you explain what you were hoping to get from him?
I thought I was going to get craft information from him. I thought I was going to get from him what I ended up giving to him. But after a while, I realized that wisdom just sort of fell out of his mouth when he was talking. And so you didn't have to pull it out of him. You just had to listen and have a conversation and pay attention to what he was saying. It was amazing to watch his humanity. There was something about him that I have rarely seen in other human beings. There was one guy, his name was Gunnars, and Gunnars had been around Capitol Hill for years, and he was this old German immigrant, and he kind of had this gruff voice. He talked like this. So he was kind of an interesting guy, but he was a little too in your face, a little too loud, a little too... I know a lot of vendors in the area really hated dealing with Gunnars. He was kind of infamous in the neighborhood. Anyway, Gunnars died. I saw August that day, and August said, hey, man, you see this man? Gunnars died, man. You know Gunnars. I'm like, yeah, I know him. He says, you going to go to the memorial? I'm like, well, no. And he goes, I'm going to go, man. I'm going. And he went. And not only did he go, he asked everyone at that funeral if Gunnars had any debts because he was going to pay his debts. Who does that? That's amazing. So I learned from him that being a human being was also part of the work. Especially after he died, I think I became more conscious of those people around me who I might ignore.
You became more of a participant.
Yeah, I did. I did.
So you were seeking him as a mentor at the very beginning. He did become that for you, but not in the way that you had planned. And that, to your surprise, you in a way became one of his many mentors in life.
Yes, I would say that I did. I was talking to him one day about story structure. He was asking for my advice, and I was explaining a principle to him. And he said to me, I should take your class, man. And I said, why would you want to take my class? I'm like, you don't need to take my class. He said, I knew a guy once who met John Coltrane. And he sheepishly said to John Coltrane, you know, I played the saxophone too. And John Coltrane said, oh, really? What can you teach me? And that was August. And he took that story. That was a story he took and incorporated into his life, that you don't get to be John Coltrane by dismissing people. You get to be John Coltrane by asking what everyone can teach you. And I think that's the way he lived his life. I think he, when he interacted with people, he wanted to know what he could learn.
Yeah. Did you have a chance to say goodbye to him? And if so, what were your final conversations like?
I didn't. He was sick, but he didn't announce he was sick for a while. Virtually every morning when he was in town, there was a coffee shop where, Cafe Ladro, and people would gather around. So he had sort of this audience of sort of people hanging around, you know. And August was going to, we knew August was going to come by and say goodbye to everyone. He was at that time very sick. It had been announced that he was sick. He was very sick. He wasn't walking. He was on a scooter. And I was told to prepare myself that he wasn't going to look like the same August, that he'd lost a lot of weight and all of that. And so I waited. We waited, and he didn't show up that day. And he was going to say goodbye to everybody, but he didn't show up that day. And then I didn't show up the next day, but the next day he did show up to say goodbye to everybody, and I missed that. And so I knew that he would sometimes, his wife would bring him out and he'd sit on his porch. And I walked by, and he was sitting there on the porch, and he looked at me but he didn't call me over. And I don't know, you know, he didn't live long after that. Did he know who I was? I don't know. I don't know who I saw there. I don't know if it was August or the cancer or, you know, or a dying guy who didn't know who he was looking at. I have no idea. But he didn't call me up, and I respected that. I didn't, you know, the man was dying.
When he started to treat you as a peer, did that in any way change your creative work?
No. But what it did change was my sense of myself. I thought I was good at what I did, what I do. But when you hit as many doors as I hit, to have somebody like August treat me as if I'm just one of them in every way, it was like they gave me some kind of a medal that I can wear with pride. I know what I'm capable of because these people who are great at it tell me what I'm capable of. And so any doubt that comes from any other direction is sort of it's sort of a shield against that.
Did he ever go to your class?
He never did. He never did. He got private tutoring, but he never came to the class. I wish he had. Yeah.
All right. Well, Brian McDonald, thank you so much for talking to us and for being on Sound Effect today.
Oh, thank you so much.
This is Sound Effect, and today we're telling stories about being under the influence. And sometimes we're under the influence of a person, for better or worse. Or maybe it's a drug. For Shannon Perry, it was an addiction to Adderall, the drug that's often prescribed for attention deficit disorder. And Shannon, she's the front woman of the Seattle band Gazebos. She's also a renowned tattoo artist. 6 years ago, she realized her addiction to Adderall was getting out of control. So she went to rehab. Writing stories and singing helped Shannon make it through that experience. She and Sound Effect contributor Arwen Nix sat down to talk about these haunting rehab recordings.
I flushed my glasses down the toilet in rehab. Oh, rehab.
If there's anything Terry felt, then I'll feel it.
To start, tell me your name.
My name is Shannon Perry.
Why in the name of seven mad gods who rule the sea was I allowed to come thus far and contemplate sand and tree?
Where were you when you recorded these?
When I recorded these, I was in a rehab called the Plymouth House in the mountains of New Hampshire.
Rain in New Hampshire.
What had you gotten sober from?
First and foremost, I had started taking Adderall to an excessive degree. I was starting to just take it all the time and maybe stay up all night. Or if you're that hopped up on Adderall, you at the end of the day, you kind of need to drink to just bring yourself back down. And so then I had started drinking heavily, like starting around like 4 or 5 p.m.
Freedom is no place if you are stuck in your head.
I don't know how deep you want, I should get right off the bat, but I was like hallucinating and having paranoia and hearing voices and stuff.
Hello there, fear. Hello there, Batman. What's up?
Like, as soon as I started seeing things, I was like, that's what insane people do. Does that mean I'm crazy? And then I went and looked online at, like, symptoms of Adderall overdose, and I had all of them.
Aggression. Anxiety. Panic, depression, blurry vision, disorientation, hallucination, rapid breathing.
I would tell myself as I'm walking and I think a demon's following me, if I turn around and look to see if it's there, am I crazy? But if I ask myself that question, do I negate the craziness? Because I've already acknowledged that looking could mean that I'm crazy. So is that awareness enough to make me not crazy? And then I look behind me.
A human is meant to be green, imagined as a screen.
I stopped taking it and went from probably what was close to like 80 or 90 milligrams a day to nothing. It's the worst. It's the worst thing I've ever quit in my life, including cigarettes and like alcohol and everything. It was like ultimate depression. Just sleep. All you can do is sleep. Like, can't even get dressed. Can't even just eat. Just eat and sleep, which is probably healthy because I think I weighed like not much more than 100 pounds at the time because I was taking so much Adderall.
Joy must be subtle or pain will run deep. The pendulum swings, it's your choice how steep.
Why are you whispering on so many of these?
I was sharing a room with a meth head and a bath salts woman. So she was the only bath salts person there. She was amazing. I mean, amazingly paranoid.
Reflection, you won't see a face. Where am I then? You ask nobody there.
Anybody could have walked in at any given moment, so I had to be sure that they I didn't want to get caught being weird, because I was often like in the fetal position on the floor, just like singing into the side of my bed.
Moon river, wider than mile.
Because I didn't want anyone to hear it. I mean, I still do that exact kind of music writing now with my apartment. I'm just like, don't want my neighbors to hear.
Oh, dream maker, you heartbreaker.
How did you have a phone to record these things on in rehab?
I didn't have a phone. When I didn't know that we could have like an iPod or anything to like listen to music on. And then Fake Dad, who is my sponsor, I call him Fake Dad, he had brought me a little like really crappy little MP3 player. But then I found out you could record on it. I was like, oh, well, this experience I'm having is so crazy and I feel so alone and so scared. It was like the thing I could do to stay sane is make something.
Sometimes I think that I'm over you. Sometimes I think about what to do or how long I had to wait to be with you, assuming you maybe feel the way that I did too. Sometimes I think that I'm over you. Sometimes I think.
When did you find these recordings?
When a friend of mine was actually going to the same rehab, I was digging through looking for an MP3 player to give him. When I was going through it, I found all these recordings, and I, of course, took them off because I was like, there's no way I'm going to let him listen to these. But then I started listening to them, and I was sort of like, oh my God, it's like a real window into the hardest, most terrifying moment of my life. It was terrifying to listen to. It still is terrifying to listen to.
It is a miserable life to be always uncomfortable with me. It is a miserable life to be always.
So when you hear those things, this time machine that you have access to Shannon from 6 or 7 years ago, like, what do you think of her?
I was insecure. I was wanting to hang out with the people I considered to be the cool kids. Wanted to be like more punk. So I think I was always trying to be brave. And I think choosing to go to rehab was me trying to be brave, and me trying to confront my own fears and emotions was me trying to be brave And I'm glad that I did it because I don't feel such a necessity to do it all the time now. Or at least I've like come to terms with some of those feelings, but I forget the question.
Shan, yeah? Be honest. Okay. Shan, yeah? Be brave. Okay.
Shan, go home and hide. Bury me
work
deep.
Hard.
I don't want to survive. Okay. Shan, go home and hide.
Yeah.
Bury me deep. I don't want to survive. Go home and hide. Bury me deep. Yeah. I don't want to survive. Go home and hide. Bury me deep. I don't want to survive.
Okay. Shan. Yeah? Take care of your responsibilities. Okay. Shan. Yeah? Okay.
That story came to us from sound effect contributor Arwen Nix. You can hear a longer version of that story in the upcoming season of the Sub Pop podcast. And you can find links to Shannon Perry's art and music at our website, knkx.org. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing. Today's theme is Under the Influence. And for Tacoma native Tim Olson, the person he wanted to hang around and learn as much as possible from was local guitar maker and musician Harvey Thomas.
His thing was to play a triple neck guitar that he had made, sitting in front of a set of organ foot pedals that he had adapted and an old-fashioned drum machine, and then he would play country western hit songs with his own satiric lyrics, and he played all the bars and things in Tacoma and Seattle.
Now, Harvey's mostly famous for making really unusual guitars in shapes like crosses and axes. Some of his original creations are on display at Seattle's Museum of Pop Culture. But he was also a larger-than-life figure. He was a stout guy with a glowering brow and giant mutton chops. And some of the things he did were really odd, like hanging guitars in the trees. He also pulled some bizarre pranks.
He had some gripe against the county government, you know, something about tax rates or something. And that he lit a car on fire in his driveway and called the fire department. Just to prank them, you know, I don't know. I mean, he would do that kind of thing, but it was his place and his stuff, and he would just do it his way.
Harvey Thomas passed away in 1987. Harvey was not a warm and fuzzy mentor to Tim, who went on to make his own guitars. But over the decades, Tim has come to revere his old teacher for more than just his craft. Sound effect producer Allie Ferguson went down to Tacoma to talk with Tim about how he first met this pretty intimidating character back in 1964 when he was in the fifth grade.
And I aspired to play a guitar, but I didn't have a guitar, so I thought I would make a guitar. I had none of the necessary equipment, knowledge, or anyone to advise me, but I went ahead and made some early attempts. So I got to the point where I had made something that looked a little like a guitar, and I needed a pickup, you know, the active electronic part. So at the music store, I asked the guy for a pickup, and he didn't have a suitable thing for an electric bass. So he hesitated, like he didn't he didn't want to say this, but he said, well, I know this guy, he's out in Midway, and he's kind of a nut, and he might like you, he might not like you, so if he doesn't like you, you know, he won't help you, but he has what you need, so you could look him up. I had to talk my parents into driving me out to halfway to Seattle to meet a guy who was kind of a nut and might not help me. So that was a hard sell, but they did eventually take me out to meet Harvey Thomas, and I met him, and in his way, he helped me.
What does that mean?
Well, he never really was encouraging. I mean, I was very encouraged by the fact that he existed, but he never said, come on, kid, you can do it. You know, it was more like, well, that's not how you do that. You use a drill, you know. And so that would have to suffice for encouragement. You know, he was an aloof mentor.
But you went back quite a bit.
Oh, I did, as much as I possibly could. I don't know, it's like going to a museum and seeing something fantastic. And knowing it's there and knowing that there is a possibility of it is just what drew me back.
And what is it about making a guitar that is so, I don't know, alluring, attractive?
Well, it's kind of infinite. You can never have made every kind of guitar or a guitar that has every wonderful quality. And on top of that is the whole aspect that then it's a tool for a musician. And then they bring something to it that you couldn't bring to it, and that's infinite. So there's really nothing like the experience of hearing a guitar that you've made being well played.
What guitar do we have here?
Well, this is a standard Maltese Cross Harvey Thomas guitar. It is shaped like a Maltese Cross.
What is a Maltese Cross?
It is a square cross with four flaring arms, like I guess like a marksman's medal or something like that. It has a long and legitimate history as a Christian symbol and as other iconic kind of a shape. You know, it's eye-catching. You don't see a Gibson or Fender built that way.
Did he have any relation to Christianity? Was that why he's building it this way, or just because of the shape?
Oh, no. No, he... he liked to shock. He liked to do outrageous things and wear and display outrageous things. And he liked to drive Cadillac hearses. He had several of them. And he would emblazon his name on the side of the hearse and drive to the gig. Yeah, he liked to draw attention to himself, shall we say. Part of that is showmanship. And part is genuine eccentricity, which I think is a type of genius of itself.
How did you know his eccentricity was authentic?
Well, it was completely played out in everything that I saw of him. You see, Harvey was a country western guy, and this was the 60s. So the country western aesthetic in those days was like suits and cowboy boots and lots of sequins and crazy emblazoned lettering and two-tone everything. At the same time, the hippies were doing something that to me was very similar. You know, a lot of wild clothing that would confound the expectations of more polite people. Hair and whisker styles that were not of the mainstream, and then a kind of a community feeling around that, you know. So as a kid coming into a hippie culture and period of my life, this all seemed just fine, right? It was just all the same kind of thing. But of course, to Harvey, as a right-wing adult, what he was doing was responsible mainstream stuff, and what those hippies were doing was some crazy. You know? So I felt a kinship that he claimed not to feel around that.
Was there a point where you realized you would kind of never get close to him, or did you ever kind of want a deeper relationship?
No, really didn't. I never aspired to, a lot of people, I think, in the stories you hear about mentor relationships, it's like dysfunctional families and this sort of thing, and they're looking for the father they never had. That wasn't my problem. I had a nicely functional family.
What was the importance of having him as a role model then, if he wasn't fulfilling that emotional need, but he certainly was fulfilling maybe like kind of an intellectual creative need?
Well, like I say, the main thing about him was his eccentricity, which was genuine and was played out in every aspect.
And how have you tried to adapt that to your life?
Well, see, there you go. I believe eccentricity is a real inborn thing, like genius.
So you're not eccentric. You wouldn't consider yourself eccentric.
No, and I don't think I'm a failed eccentric.
But are there parts of that way of living, that boldness that you've incorporated into your life?
Well, here's an example. This house I'm living in here was not built as a house. It was built as an Odd Fellows Lodge Hall in 1891. So when Deb and I got married and were looking for a place, I had to have the possibility of a guitar shop. So we were thinking about, a tiny little apartment and then renting somebody's garage or something like that. We drove by this place. It had a for sale sign on it. We weren't thinking of buying because we didn't have any money, and my folks didn't have any money, her folks didn't have any money. But we said, let's call them up and have a look at that place, because don't you wonder what's inside there? And so we did, and it turned out to be cheap, and we were able to swing it. But yeah, I think Harvey's example gave me some courage to think that something as far out of the mainstream as owning an Odd Fellows Lodge Hall as opposed to renting an apartment was at least worth investigating. So thanks, Harvey. You gave me a little courage there.
That was Tim Olson talking with sound effect producer Allie Ferguson. These days, Tim uses the first floor of his old Odd Fellows Lodge to publish and distribute the American Luthry magazine, a quarterly journal for guitar makers. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Jennifer Wing. And today the theme is Under the Influence. And this final story in the show is about books. One of the debates going on in the publishing world right now is who should be telling whose stories. For example, if you're a white author, do you have the authority to write a character who is black, an experience you have not lived? Now, I know that some of you out there might be thinking that this is political correctness that is way over the top, but the debate, it's real, and a new industry is emerging that's offering guidance to writers who are concerned about how their own prejudices might creep into their work. Sound Effect contributor Kyle Norris introduces us to two writers who are grappling with this issue in the world of children's books.
Will Taylor has been working for 6 years at becoming a published children's book author. And in 2018, HarperCollins will publish his first book in a two-part series that he wrote. It's called Maggie and Abby's Never-Ending Pillow Fort. It's meant for kids age 9 to 12. And to make that happen, he sought the advice of a woman he never met. But before we get into that, here's more about Will. He grew up in Seattle, and he loved to read books about kids who set off on magic adventures and encountered difficult problems, but figured them out. Those stories meant something to him.
That there was more beauty and magic and wonder available in the world than what I was seeing immediately in front of me.
Will is 35, and gay, and white. As a kid, he remembers movies and TV shows where gay men were pedophiles, or they were stereotypes of effeminate men, and they were there for a laugh. Those stereotypes were so horrifying to Will that he stayed in the closet until his mid-20s, because he didn't want to be like the characters he saw. Will understands the power of media and made a promise to himself that whatever he creates will not hurt kids and reinforce stereotypes, especially for kids of color.
I want to do absolutely everything in my power to make sure that my own work, the books that I want to be magical and beautiful doors and windows for kids to have at their disposal as they're growing up and doing all the things, dealing with all the hardships that growing up brings. I want my books to be safe spaces.
To figure out if this imaginary world he built did this successfully, he hired someone to review his story. He reached out online to an author named Bethany Morrow in upstate New York. She's African American, and she's part of a newish profession known as sensitivity readers.
A sensitivity read is where I am reading for offensive, harmful, stereotypical representation of an underrepresented or a non-represented group of people.
A sensitivity reader comes from a specific racial minority, religious minority, sexual orientation, or identity. They comb through an author's text from their cultural perspective and then give their feedback.
I'm basically reading to make sure that the author, who obviously by definition does not fall into one of those groups, is doing more than relying on stereotypes.
A sensitivity read is not a guarantee that no one will be offended, nor are they stamps of approval.
You know, I'm not your token black girlfriend, basically. That's not the purpose. Anybody who wants to hear the truth, I am here for you. If you want me to tell you the truth, I am totally down to tell you the truth.
Bethany and Will have never met in person. They've only communicated through email and words on a page. Not everyone thinks this is a good idea. It's been called political correctness gone too far. Bethany's response is this is about protecting young readers of color. And she says, if you were an author, you would have an editor.
If you're going to write a story about a 17th century botanist, you're probably going to do some research. You're probably going to find somebody who's an expert. You're not going to just wing it. And people having a hard time, or not a hard time, refusing to acknowledge that you don't get to be the authority on everyone else's identity.
So why not fact check when it comes to race, sexual identity, or anything else that's not part of your lived experience? Growing up in Sacramento, Bethany loved to read all kinds of genres and write. Her family made sure she was surrounded with black narratives and stories and art and poetry. In school, they were one of a few black families. There was a moment when she realized her experience was unusual. It happened in her 7th grade language arts class. They were watching a film that starred Alfonso Ribeiro. You might know him as Carlton Banks on The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Alfonso was the only black person in the movie. And whenever he came on screen, all of Bethany's white classmates laughed at him, even though he wasn't doing anything funny. In that moment, she felt shame. She also realized her classmates weren't reading stories or watching shows about black people, like the miniseries Roots on TV.
I thought everyone was going home and watching Roots. I thought everybody's parents read to them, you know, from different poets. And because I never felt like an outsider or felt like I was something strange, I just assumed that my upbringing was the norm. So I think at that moment, I also realized they were not used to seeing me on the screen. So I also became aware, and that I think is only made me more passionate, and it went from frustrated to no, you don't get this option. You don't get to pretend that I don't exist while I'm completely, you know, overwhelmed with your presence.
The world of children's literature remains lily white. 73% of characters in kids' books are white. 12% of characters are non-human things like animals or trucks. 8% of characters are African American. That's according to an organization called the Cooperative Children's Book Center. And just to repeat that, there are more animals and trucks in kids' books than there are black kids. And the overwhelming majority of authors who write books for kids are white. Will Taylor, the author we met earlier, the guy who hired Bethany to read his book for Bias, he knows he's writing from a white dude's perspective. And he wanted to know how that affected the job he did in his upcoming book.
I knew I was very unaware of a lot of the cultural biases I brought with me. So I wanted to ask someone who had the experience of being in the community that I was trying to represent how I did.
Will was ready to hear the truth.
I thought I'd done a really good job. I expected an A+ and a pat on the head. And that's really embarrassing to say now, because that's not at all what I got.
What he got was one page of Bethany's single-spaced, 12-point font, very clear notes. There's one stereotype that Bethany sees all the time. She saw it in Will's text. It's when authors write black girls and women with attitudes.
I might specifically say, this is the only black woman in the book. Why does she roll her neck when she talks? Talking with your neck, rolling your neck, it's just a stereotype of, I guess, what people would say of an inner city girl or something. It's just indicative of having an attitude usually. What about that isn't immediately just based on your ingested, you know, stereotype of black women?
I had written a character with a huge amount of attitude. A lot of the culture that I've consumed as a queer man has been a love for powerful black women. And I tried to bring that, what I thought was an accurate representation of that, into this girl character. And the feedback was that it was not okay because it came across as attitude.
Bethany says Will's African-American character, Maisha, was not fully formed. Maisha was an obstacle for the protagonist, Maggie, who is white, to overcome.
This is a scene where Maggie, the main character, is having a bit of a debate with Maisha, who is a leader of a group of kids who she's interacting with. "I bet you we could handle 100 pillow forts," Maggie said. "It sounds like fun." Maisha threw up her hands. "And see, that right there is why you are not ready to join us." She turned away and spoke under her breath. "Can't believe I'm even having this conversation with a beginner. Girl has no idea who she's dealing with." My original intention with that scene had been to show that Maisha was a strong leader with a ton of experience who just wasn't going to suffer fools. If you're a young black girl reading this book, and this is the only person like you in the book, and all she does is talk back to the main character and then eventually be proved wrong, what are you doing? I hadn't noticed that pattern.
Because of what Bethany saw in his story that he didn't see, Will made Maisha more of a whole person. He says it ended up making the book much better. These sensitivity reads, Bethany says, they are really just a Band-Aid on the gaping wound of a bigger problem, of not having enough minority authors telling their stories. She wants the literary world to make space for these voices.
What I want to see happen is for people to take responsibility for their privilege, and that if you actually want to be part of the solution, you are going to have to forfeit your privilege. There's no way around it. You can't keep it and also make an equitable situation for everyone else.
Will agrees with Bethany. He's asking himself how he can be a part of that change. And when he looks back on working with a sensitivity reader, here is his big takeaway.
Good intentions do not go very far when it comes to writing outside your lane. It's so easy to do harm when you come from a place of privilege and you're not a member of a marginalized community and try and write about them.
From here on out, Will is going to use a sensitivity reader for everything he writes. He's much more aware now of making characters their own, quote, complete awesome person, acting on their own agency. But Will's also asking himself, if writing outside your own lane is appropriate, is it even possible without bias creeping in, no matter how well-intended you are?
That was Sound Effect contributor Kyle Norris. To hear Bethany Morrow reading an excerpt from her essay, Why We Need Black Characters by Real Black Authors, go to our website, knkx.org. This brings us to the end of the show. Sound Effect comes to you from producers Kevin Kniestad and Allie Ferguson. Erin Hennessy is our executive producer. We get web help from Dave Nagaris. Parker Miles Blom gets the word out on social media. Thanks this week to Arwen Nix, Kyle Norris, Amanda Abbott, and the entire Lewis family. You can find Sound Effect on the NPR One app, and you can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. We'll be back next week when it's all about sports.
And I was like, ooh, what if I give him superpowers? And I thought, ooh, I'll add a personal element. I'll give him part of my story. He has a disability, cerebral palsy, and he dreams of being a soccer gladiator like his father.
I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is 88.5 KNKX.